Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean pulls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Deeper Waters podcast. My name is Nick Peters. I'm here hoping to bring you the very best in Christian apologetics. And as you all know, if you're listening to this live, this is the Saturday before Christmas. So this is going to be our last show before Christmas. And I hope you all have a wonderful Christmas this year. We're definitely looking forward to ours. It's going to be the first Christmas we've spent in this new home together. So it's going to be a very exciting Christmas, and one of the ideas that we've been wanting to get is trying to establish new traditions, as it were. Of course, the first year, they're not traditions, but, you know, you have to give them started sometime. You know, there are several traditions that we have built up around Christmas. We give gifts, we have Santa Claus come down the chimney, we burn the Yule log, we have mistletoe, we have the nativity scenes, everything. And it can sometimes get us wondering, geez, where did those traditions come from? Well, to help us discuss that today and answer questions about them, including the question of, could some of these be pagan in origin, I have with me Dr. Anthony McCrory. Anthony McCrory is a visiting lecturer at the Wales Evangelical School of Theology, and his PhD is in Islamic Studies. He's spoken on this on Unbelievable, so I got in touch with Justin and said, hey, can I get in touch with this guy? Sure. So, he is here to help us talk about this topic today. Dr. McCrory, are you here with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Good to have you here. Now, Christmas traditions are an interesting topic to study in. Your PhD in Islamic studies, how did you get into the area of Christmas traditions, and just how did you get where you are today?
Well, in terms of, that's the last question first. I'm originally from an Irish Catholic background, and I was converted during my student days. And then I went on to specialise afterwards in Islamic studies. Although beforehand I used to be a lecturer in Christian doctrine and New Testament theology, early church history and so forth. Now, how I got into about Christmas is that a few years ago, a couple of Western converts to Islam in Britain wrote a book basically attacking Christianity. And one of the issues they raised about Christmas, and they claimed it was of pagan origin, and they claimed that it was largely based on the worship of Mithras, who was a Roman god. So I decided to start searching this, and I found that all of this was simply an urban legend. You know, you have that expression in America. It was all nonsense, just repeated by, someone said it, and someone else repeated it, and then someone else repeated it. That's a bit like Chinese whispers, as we call it here. And there's simply no evidence that the festival of Christmas does in any way derive from pagan festivals.
Okay. Dr. McCrory, I am hearing from people that they do want you to turn the volume up on you a little bit. It is a little bit hard to hear right now, but what we did get is that you got this because some Muslims were making a claim that Christmas is pagan, comes from pagan origins, especially Mithras as well. Now, what I think you've said before also is that, sadly, Christians are responsible for some of these myths, aren't they?
Yes, they do. They tend to repeat this because even though this was actually held by some of the Puritans in North America, like I think Cotton Martha, great Puritan in New England, made some comments that claimed that that Christmas was based on the Roman festival of the Saturnalia, whereas the Saturnalia actually finished before the 25th of December, and the nearest festival, Roman pagan festival to 25th of December was the Laurentalia, which was a feast of the dead. Now, quite obviously, nothing in Christmas is anything about death, is it? So it's a common belief amongst even amongst Christians, but that's because they just imbibed all what they've seen on television, what they've seen on YouTube or whatever, and they haven't bothered to properly investigate it. And this is a big lesson for us, that we shouldn't just accept anything that someone says, but we should first of all investigate. And please, I do invite everyone, whatever I say today about Christmas, please go and investigate it from primary sources. Don't take my word for it. I don't ask that of anyone. Could you hear all that, by the way?
Yeah, it is getting better. Here it seems to come and go sometimes, but it's much better. Now, you when you've been saying that Christians need to research this, usually we'll be told, well, just open up the Encyclopedia Britannica, or go look at Wikipedia, or something like that. What sort of sources should Christians be checking with these claims? How should they be going about their research here?
Well, it depends what it is they want to look at. There's various academic groups that far too many agreed to quote at the present time. For example, let's think about the Roman gods and this accusation about them. The obvious thing, you often hear this, for example, down at London's Hyde Park, where we have lots of Muslims turn up there, and it's the big thing, it's called Speaker's Corner, where anyone can get up and speak about anything they want on a Sunday and say what they like. And Christians are often, Christian speakers are often kind of heckled by Muslims, saying that that particularly this time of the year, that Christmas was the birthday, 25th December rather, was the birthday of some pagan deity. And so I looked at this, and the best way to do it is to look at the different people, different gods they claim, and then to go back to Greek, Roman, Egyptian, and Babylonian sources to see what they say. Like, for example, the classic one would be Adonis, the Greek god. And I looked at what Apollodorus, an early Greek writer, says about it. And his festival was celebrated in June and July. Dionysus, who the Romans called Bacchus, his celebration was just towards the end of November and the start of December, and then in Rome it was celebrated in March. I could go on. For example, about Mithras, the thing about Mithras, I contacted a leading academic scholar of Mithraism, and he said that no one knows if the worshippers of Mithras even had a kind of sacred calendar, and we don't know what day, if at all, Mithras was celebrated on. And we could go on and on. Another one is Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun. This is another a Roman god. And actually, when you look at, they often say that 25th of December, which is linked to the winter solstice, was his birthday. But then I looked at, there was a Dutch scholar in Canada who wrote about the worship of Sol Invictus, Dr. Hymans, and he pointed out that the holy days of Sol Invictus were August the 8th, August the 9th, August the 28th, October the 19th, and the 22nd, and December the 11th, not December the 25th. And you can find this from Roman sources. And that's the important thing. Go back to the original sources. And there's not one god that people, you find either atheist or Islamic apologists claiming the 25th of December, who was actually celebrated on that date.
Okay. Well, I'm curious, especially with Mithras one, which scholar was Asker's? Mithraism is something that I've looked at quite a bit. Was it by any chance David Ulansey?
No. It was Dr. Richard Gordon, who's one of the leading scholars in the world. Also, he's got Dr. Roger Beck's works. They just don't know. The thing is about Mithraism, just knock this on the head completely. The only only evidence we have for Mithraism, that's subjective, is what they've left of their iconography, their painting, if you like, and also what they've left of inscriptions. Beyond that, we don't have any firm evidence about what they believe, and certainly we don't know anything about their calendar. So you keep hearing this on programs on TV and on YouTube and whatever, and it's absolute nonsense. We just have no evidence.
Yeah, which leads one of the great dangers, because a lot of Christians will spread this idea that Christmas is pagan, and one of the great dangers they're prone to fall into then is this whole pagan copycat theory, where they could be told, well, geez, everything in Christianity is pagan. Just look at all this. Look at how much was stolen from Mithras, from Bacchus, from Horus, from all these other sources. I mean, that's a very real danger, isn't it?
Well, again, Horus is another one that I've heard. And he, according to Plutarch, the Greek writer, in his book The Morals, his birthday was celebrated on the 26th of July.
Nothing
to do with the 25th, is it? Not December.
But
again, none of these people who make these comments go back to the original Greek, Roman, and other sources. They're basically, someone has said it at one time, they all had their birthday on the 25th of December, it just keeps being reproduced. And what you never see is them giving a primary source. Now, I'm a lecturer. I'm a scholar. I have to prepare people for external exams of British universities who are not they're not marking you on your piety. They're marking you on your scholarship. And what I always say to my students is always go back to the original sources. Their primary sources are called academia. Primary sources. So if you want to know about anything about Horus, go and look at what, amongst his Greek worshippers, go look what Plutarch writes. If you want to know about Dionysus and Bacchus, the Bacchanalia, go and look at Ovid and his book The Metamorphoses. This is what you do. You just do not reproduce what Joe Bloggs or John Doe, I mean, we call him in America. Well, we call him Joe Bloggs over here. You just don't reproduce what anyone says. You go back to the original sources.
Okay. Well, we've been talking mainly about December 25th, and you're pretty much making a strong case that no pagan holiday, or birthday at least, was celebrated on December 25th, but is there any evidence that Christians did early on celebrate Jesus' birthday on December 25th?
Well, there's not a lot of reference to it early on. We seem to think it was probably celebrated round about the start of the 4th century or maybe the late 2nd century, because of certain things that Augustine, of Hippo, he was around at the end of the 4th century, end of the 5th century. And one of the things he does that he attacks the Donatists. And these were a schism. They weren't heretics. They're just a schismatic group, because they thought that some people who compromised during the Roman persecution had been let back too easily. And one of the things he condemns them for is a sermon in one of his sermons is that he says that he complains about them not celebrating. This is it. His sermon 202. He notes that they didn't celebrate Epiphany on January the 6th. Now that's quite quite related to Christmas, isn't it? Obviously. Now the fact is, the Donatist schism occurred round about 311. Now that he never condemns them for not celebrating Christmas on December 25th. Now if he's condemning them for not celebrating Epiphany, but he makes no mention about Christmas, then it would seem logical to infer that the Donatists in North Africa were celebrating Christmas. And since the Donatist schism occurred in 311, and before that, you had the last great persecution of the church under Diocletian, it could mean that around about 300 or even earlier, that people, at least in North Africa, were actually celebrating the Nativity on December 25th. It could go back that far.
Do we have any mentions of December 25th before that?
No, not that I can come across.
Okay.
But then you expect, in the sense that, you know, they're far more important things to talk about. Didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
They were being persecuted. They were
yeah.
talking about redemption in general. So they're not going to focus on December 25th or any other
mm-hmm.
day. The main thing mm-hmm. that they said, quote, we do know was celebrated quite early on was Easter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we could even say there probably wouldn't have been much need for them to mention it, because most anyone would know that Christians celebrated on December 25th, and if they didn't know, it could be because they don't want to alert, say, the Romans, say, hey, this is the day we all gather together and celebrate if you want to come and slaughter us.
I know, I'm not quite sure about that, because the Romans did know they gathered on a Sunday. It's simply that... one theory is that the original Easter celebration that seems to have grown up pretty strong, pretty quickly in the second century, that
mm-hmm.
actually, not only to the death and resurrection of Christ, but everything else, including the birth and so forth, that gradually people began to focus on different aspects of the life of Jesus. So
mm-hmm.
I think it was simply that, and that they were always celebrating, they were always going to remember the incarnation and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Gradually, they began to focus on a particular date. Then the big rivalry at first was between January the 6th and December 25th. Even today, some mm-hmm. of the Eastern churches still celebrate the Nativity on December or January the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
But that was why, you know, there was these two theories, and eventually, particularly in the West, December 25th won out. And my attitude to this, if I can just say, as a Briton, is we always every year celebrate the official birthday of Her Majesty the Queen, and that takes place in the warmer months, so there's a lot of pageantry involved, as you can imagine, with the army are out there, you know, with the cannons and so forth. But that's not the actual birthday of the Queen. The Queen's birthday is much earlier, but we celebrate it there basically so it's not, the event isn't going to be rained off and the tourists can come and see it. But the important point is we're celebrating the birth of the Queen. Doesn't matter when we celebrate it, we celebrate that, the glorious fact of our present Queen's birth. And in a sense, it doesn't matter when we celebrate the birth of Christ. It matters that we do celebrate it, because so much of the gospel is actually focused on the birth of Christ. And within the narratives of the Nativity, everything else is basically incipient. Like, for example, the angel says, you should call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. So already we get right at, even before Jesus is born in his human nature, he will save his people from their sins. And of course, we know by Calvary how he does that.
Mm-hmm. And we can even look that he's given the name Emmanuel, which is a royal throne name, meaning God with us. And the Gospel of Matthew ends with, I'll be with you into the age. So the whole idea is from beginning to end, Jesus is God with us.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're going to go ahead now and take an early break. We've got Dr. Anthony McCrory with us, and we're talking about Christmas traditions. We'll be back, and we'll be opening up the lines for your calls after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're back. My guest is Dr. Anthony McCrory from the Wales Evangelical School of Theology. We're talking about Christmas traditions. Now, if you have a question you'd like to call in and ask about Christmas, the number is 714-242-5180. Our lines are fully open, so please give us a call and let's talk about Christmas. Now, there's another idea I've heard about how we get to the date of Christ's birth, and that's actually the date of Christ's death. And it's because it was believed, supposedly by the Jews, that a prophet would die the same day he came into the world. And so if Jesus died on March 25th, and he was conceived on March 25th, and he'd be born on December 25th. Have you ever heard this, and what do you think of it?
Yes, that is becoming increasingly various scholars. It's even been on British TV by a scholar who isn't a Christian has said that. Mm. It's based on the Jewish Midrashic tradition of, it's called the Integral Age of the Prophets, that a prophet would die on the same date he was born. Now, obviously, with Jesus, the miracle is the conception, because we talk about the virgin birth, but really, we should be talking about the virginal conception, shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
That's the miracle. And therefore, the belief was that Jesus died on the 25th of March. He would have been conceived on that date. Or the other alternative view was that Passover was on the April the 6th. So therefore, mm-hmm. he would have been born on January the 6th, which is why you get the two dates. And I think mm-hmm. that's far more logical because, as I said, there's simply no evidence of any pagan gods being associated with the 25th of December. So it's not a case of borrowing.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we've mentioned the virgin conception borrowing, I did have Ben Witherington on here a couple of weeks ago, and he gave his answer to this question, so let's ask it to you since we're talking about the possibility of borrowing. Some Muslims and such, well, probably not Muslims since they believe in the virgin conception, but a lot of atheists will say that the story of a virgin conception was also borrowed from pagan myths. What's your answer to that?
Again, I've looked at this, and I can't find a single evidence of a virgin giving birth. In all the Greek and Roman, the Greek or Roman legends, it's always that the god comes and basically has intercourse with the girl.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That is not what we teach. It's not what the Bible teaches. There's no intercourse between God and Mary. Right? Yeah. It's this very, very different idea. You know, again, I challenge anyone who's saying this not to just repeat a factoid, an urban legend, but to give an actual Greco-Roman source. Like I've mentioned, you know, people like Pausanias and people like that, and so forth. And that's what I want. Please give me that. Mm-hmm. But you know, like if you can't find that, then just recognise that it's simply not accurate.
David Enstone Brewer was also on a show one time, and he's written a book, The Jesus Scandals, and he said that not only does this concept not exist from a pagan, it would have been, and as Ben Witherington agrees with, it would have been embarrassing for the Christians to point it out, because it would be hinting that Jesus was born in a way that people would deem as illegitimate, which wouldn't be a real selling point for a Messiah figure.
No. Again, obviously you do have the prophecy of the virgin birth in Isaiah, although some try to make out that it's translated young woman. But the fact is, definitely when it gets to Greek, it is Parthenos, it can only mean virgin. But that was in other Jewish messianic beliefs at the time, that wasn't emphasized as far as I'm aware.
Mm-hmm.
But still, when you got to the pagan world and you're telling people about this, either they would have laughed or assumed it was along the same lines as their legends about sexual intercourse between gods and humans, which is definitely not what the gospel teaches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I can already imagine that some atheists out there are saying, well, isn't that what Justin Martyr said to the emperor, though? Didn't he say, we don't believe anything really different from what you all believe?
Well, Justin was trying to find common ground. He always regarded himself as a philosopher. And obviously, basically, what he's trying to do is find a bridge to explain the gospel. And I think that's a warning to us. We've got to be careful about sometimes our presentation of the gospel and try to find analogies which are not really there. It's one of the things why I would say when I'm talking to Muslims about various issues, and I'd say to them, this is analogous. I don't say it's the same. I say it's analogous. But then I say, obviously, it's an imperfect analogy. And that's the best we can do. Give an imperfect analogy with other beliefs. but we'll never actually get fully there because what we believe is unique.
And the Jews were very guarded as well, weren't they, with wanting to avoid any of their religion being tainted with paganism. They might be fine with some aspects of Greek culture and such, but they wouldn't let it touch their religion at all.
No, not at this time, no. The only thing was the Sadducees, who were the most powerful group. They, as we read in the Gospels, they didn't believe in the afterlife as the Pharisees believed in. But generally, no, they would have looked, at that time, the Jews, or anywhere, would have looked at paganism with horror. And one of the interesting things is, look at, when the Gospel does go out into the pagan world, particularly with the Apostle Paul, there is no compromise whatsoever. For example, he says you can't drink the cup of idols, which is the cup of demons, and the cup of the Lord. You cannot compromise with it. You cannot take part in pagan festivals, he says. It's an important point, he says in 1 Corinthians. He goes on to attack the sexual promiscuity of the pagans. And for example, very topically, it's very clear that he will not accept any homosexual action. Acts. Now, that was very prominent in Greece. In Greece, it was just seen as natural. Men did vote, who were bisexual, if you like. They acted in a bisexual way. And he is completely uncompromising on that issue, as we know from Romans 1, for example. And so, people are trying to say that the Christians compromised with paganism. Well, where is the evidence? They simply didn't. If you look at the polemic we read in Paul's writings against every aspect of pagan belief and popular culture, he does stand out against it.
Well, we could be told that, well, that's Paul's writing, but what about the early church? Did they take a similar stance?
Oh, yes, it's very clear that if you read through obviously we don't have time to go through it, but I've written about this. That they were very strong about not taking part in the Saturnalia, very clear. For example, Oregon, he made this comment that they don't take part in those pagan festivals. Tertullian warned against taking part in things like the Saturnalia. So they never ever compromised. For example, here it is. Tertullian, just for those who don't know, he was there in the late 2nd, early 3rd century. He was from North Africa. And in his book On Idolatry, he insisted that Christians shouldn't take part in pagan festivals. And in chapter 14 of On Idolatry, he specifically attacks participation in Saturnalia. Now, usually those people who try and claim that Christmas is derived from pagan festival, they look to the Saturnalia, which again ended on the stretch of the 17th to the 23rd of December, not the 25th. And here we have a Latin North African Christian, Tertullian, making it very clear that we must not take part in pagan festivals. And if you look at all the sermons of the early church, people like Gregory Nazianzen and so forth, they're making it very clear that we must not take part in that festival. That they actually said we should fast and worship, not basically booze and gorge yourself, as they were doing at the Saturnalia. We must be careful to distinguish ourselves. Again and again, all these writers are saying this. So the early church did not compromise.
I have received another request to see if you could turn up the volume some more on your end. Unfortunately, I can't do much with that here. But,
I don't know how.
Okay, that's better. Much better. Okay. Now, having said all this, then if they didn't get it from the pagans, then we could have good reason to believe that the reason they came up with December 25th could in fact be that they actually thought that was the day Jesus was born. Would that be accurate?
At the time, yes, it probably that or January the 6th, depending on when you dated the Passover. Yes, that would be accurate. That would be one of the reasons. But, like I said, I've read various people writing on this, and it's impossible to come to any conclusion. Alfred Edersheim, he actually did think it was likely that Jesus was born about that time. Others have said, no, it was a different date in November or other times. But like I said, we shouldn't get worked up about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, it's like I said, what we do in Britain when we celebrate the Queen's birthday, that's the official birthday we celebrate. And the point is, Jesus set apart one day in the year when we remember and specifically focus on his nativity and what that means. And that's the big point. And I remember, a preacher should preach throughout the entire Bible, shouldn't he? So at some point,
mm-hmm.
a local church and the minister thereof should be preaching upon the nativity narratives.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to be ashamed of setting apart December the 25th.
Mm-hmm.
Well, since you just brought up the nativity narratives, maybe we should go there and talk about what's going on with nativity narratives or accounts. Now, but let's talk about the nativities we often have set up in our houses. My wife, for instance, is a big animal person. And one thing I've heard is that animals weren't really part of a nativity scene until St. Francis of Assisi came along.
Animals, did you say?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, that's partly true. It was, in the 6th century, we do have some evidence that it was even being practiced then. For example, Caesarius of Arles. Now, Arles is a place in modern France. In his sermon 190, remember this is in the 6th century, he says, "Let us prepare a crib, a cradle brilliant with the flowers of the bloodline, perpetual sweetness of its fragrance. Let us receive the tiny little Lord in our hearts." But, like you said, you were quite right that the modern crib has been associated with Francis of Assisi, because he did set up a big Bethlehem scene, and apparently the place where it's, I think it's, in it it's called Greccio, they still do have this every year, the big Bethlehem scene.
And if I remember also, St. Francis of Assisi is seen as the patron saint of animals as well.
In this particular case, what he did was to have the Bethlehem scene with an ox and an ass.
Mm-hmm. Now, usually also in our nativity scenes, we'll have the shepherds and the magi all together right there at the birth, but chances are that didn't happen that way, did it?
No, according to the narrative in Matthew, it's... There's no indication that the Magi were there with the shepherds. And it does seem at this point, particularly because Herod decrees that all boys under 2 should be killed, by this time Jesus was a toddler. So it would have been maybe a year or 18 months or so after, or even up to 2 years. We don't know exactly afterwards. But the Magi weren't there at the birth. They were there shortly after.
Now, the shepherds, though, they, from what we gather in the Lucan account, they would have been there practically immediately, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes, yes. There's a town on the west bank called Beit Sahur, and the actual insignia of this Palestinian city is the shepherds. And this is quite likely the place where they were. They would have been what is now Beit Sahur, which is quite near Bethlehem. And it's there they would have been told by the angels that Jesus had been born. There was a Jewish tradition that the first revelation of the Messiah would come from Migdal Eder, which it was called then, where the shepherds would watch the temple flocks all the year round. And so it's quite likely that the shepherds were rearing sheep for the temple sacrifice, which then, if you think back to it, when Jesus is first revealed as a grown man, John the Baptist states when he sees him coming, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." So and remember that Jesus laid in a manger for shepherds to see. So the Messiah, whose dominion, if you like, was revealed at Migdal Eder to the shepherds, caring for sacrificial sheep, encounter the Messiah in the city of David, Bethlehem. They find him in the manger, the sacrificial lamb, who will save his people from their sins.
Mm-hmm. Now, before that time, were shepherds seen, I know they were seen by the Egyptians, were they usually seen as a more shameful lot, a group that you really couldn't trust, that Jews didn't hold shepherds in high esteem?
Well, sometimes I've heard this, but we need to remember that David himself, King David, you know, was caring for sheep. And one of the titles of the shepherd is sometimes used of God in the Old Testament, sometimes used of the king. So it might be the kind of work that a lot of people wouldn't want to do, but I think we've got to be careful about exaggerating this too much.
Right, but the shepherds coming, they also definitely would not have been the most noble people out there, so Christ has his...
No, they were very ordinary people, yes.
Which would mean the first very revelations of Christ to come to other people would in fact have been to the peasant common folk that were out there instead of the great nobles.
Yes, but I'm not convinced that is the particular import of the Nativity narrative. I think the point is that they were probably shepherds rearing sacrificial sheep for the temple. And that's the
mm-hmm.
point, is the fact that that David was a shepherd, and you know, near Bethlehem, and this is to show the parallel between David and the fact that Jesus is going to be the sacrificial lamb. I think that's the big point that we want to make out. That there's no real emphasis on the fact that the shepherds are just lowly characters in the narratives. We've got to stick to what the text actually says and not go beyond it.
Now, on the other hand, we can look at the Magi, who come later and treat Jesus in a very different way than the shepherds do. So what can we learn about the Magi?
Well, again, there's two theories of it. The one I would think is right is that the Magi, see, we know the Magi were the priests of Zoroastrianism. Now, Zoroastrianism was the religion of ancient Iran, and the temples of its religion stretched from Armenia to Afghanistan and south to Bahrain. And Zoroastrians, they had, and I believe still have, a belief in an eschatological deliverer to come at the end of the world, which would be called the Soshant, the benefactor. And in Zoroastrian sacred texts, it tells us about him that he would... He would teach us the straight paths of blessedness in this life, true paths that lead to the world where Ahura Mazda, in other words, the god of light, a faithful man, well-knowing and like the god of light, Ahura Mazda. And so they were looking to that, and also, they were also looking for the fact that he was going to be virgin-born. So the Soshin would be born of Zoroaster's seed preserved in Lake Kassoya, but he would be virgin-born. This is an important thing. And then another text says that he would embody righteousness, and that when he comes, he would drive evil out of the world and establish the right order. So this is probably what was going on in their minds. You know, they'd heard of someone who was born of a virgin, and somehow God communicates to them that this has happened in Bethlehem.
Okay, well, that's a fascinating point for us, as we're coming to our second break. Gives us a great point we can come back to. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We're talking about Christmas traditions with Dr. Anthony McCrory from the Wales Evangelical School of Theology, and we'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Rock Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite rock radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, CYIWorldwide.com. Rock Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We're back. We've got Anthony McCoy here talking about Christmas traditions. Now, you've just been saying these magi have been coming looking for a king. So what would it mean then if Herod's sitting in his palace and all of a sudden here come these rulers, these magi rather, from a foreign land and saying, hey, we're looking for the new king. Where is he?
Well, I think one of the points we've got to say before we get to that is that they come all the way to Jerusalem, and they don't see the star. The star brings them to Jerusalem, but doesn't bring them further at that point. At that point, then, they say, we've heard of this king of the Jews being born, and they find out where he's going to be born through the Old Testament, what we call now the Old Testament, the biblical text. Because now Herod, he was very effective as a ruler, and he did a lot of development in his kingdom. Obviously, he built the temple, but he was ruthless. He was a kind of Saddam Hussein figure. In fact, the Emperor Augustus once joked that it was safer to be Herod's pig than his son. And that's in Greek, they almost rhyme, because obviously being obviously practicing the Jewish religion, Herod wasn't going to raise pigs and slaughter them. But he slaughtered his own sons when he felt that they threatened his rule. How much more would he stand against anyone, even who wasn't part of his family? So, naturally, he felt very insecure because, for a start, he didn't really have any claim to the throne. He wasn't of the line of David. Once he's heard that there is going to be someone of the line of David, who's the true and legitimate king, he's naturally going to be very scared, and he's also going to be very ruthless, and we see that in what he does in Bethlehem with the massacre of the innocents.
Now, Tim McGrew and Ben Witherington have both been on here as well. They both stated that Herod was, in fact, incredibly paranoid, and he paid great attention to portents and signs.
Yes, he was. But like I said, he didn't hear of any signs. The very fact that he'd heard of the birth of someone with a legitimate claim to the throne would have been enough to cause him to act the way he did.
Okay. Now, you talked about the star that the Magi saw. What was this star exactly?
Again, there's different theories about this. But the star, I don't personally think it can be an ordinary star. Because remember, the star guides them. The stars don't move in quite the same way. I know people try to make out just Venus or whatever, but I find it very unlikely because the star guides them to Jerusalem, and then it seems to stop for a while, and then they see it again in Bethlehem, and it actually directs them right to Jesus. So I tend to think it was a supernatural manifestation from God, rather than any kind of just ordinary star.
It could have been something like an angel, then.
Not necessarily an angel, no, just that God created a star in the firmament that moved, and then it disappeared because its purpose had been fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the Magi, we usually say there are three of them, but the text never really says there were three Magi.
No, it doesn't. No, in fact, fairly early on it seems to be associated with three, but that's obviously just because it mentions the three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. There's a mid-third century fresco in the catacombs of Rome, the catacomb of Priscilla, which shows the three magi approaching Jesus. In Western tradition, they were, by the 6th century, it was held that there were three of them, usually Melchior, Balthasar, and Caspar. But in the Syriac tradition, kind of in the east, around Syria, Palestine, and parts of what's now Turkey and Iraq, they actually held that there were 12. And like for example, there's a 10th century Syriac Nestorian historian, Abdul Hassan Balul, who actually said to the 12, and he gives their names as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't know how many there were. In fact, I would say it's most unlikely there would just be three. Because in those days, three travelers coming all the way from either what's now Iran and Iraq to Jerusalem, you would face bandits. You would be sick ducks. So I would think it's more likely that there was a large delegation of them coming. And that's why when they get to Jerusalem, all Jerusalem starts speaking about them. If only three people came, no one's going to notice. If there's a big delegation of Persians suddenly turning up, then obviously that's going to set tongues wagging, and King Herod's going to hear about it, isn't he?
Yeah, and if they're taking with them valuable gifts like gold, frankincense, and myrrh, obviously they can afford these gifts, and if they can afford these gifts, chances are they'd hire some people to go with them to keep them safe on their journey, because you don't want these gifts to get stolen.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, just their own persons. Anyone traveling in those days would have faced the possibility of bandits, and there was safety in numbers. And if I could just say something about the gifts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I was about to ask, in fact.
Yeah. Well, see, early on, people like Irenaeus, in the 2nd century, Irenaeus was the kind of bishop in Lyon, in modern France. He said it was myrrh because he was he who should die and be buried for the most of the human race, gold because he was a king of whom his kingdom was no end, and frankincense because he was God, who was also made known in Judea and declared to those who sought him not. Yet the text never says that. The text of the Bible never says that. And the interesting point is, all of what's now stretching, you know, basically from the borders, well, including part of Turkey down to the Sinai and over to Iraq, was part of the kingdom of Coele Syria after Alexander the Great died and his empire was divided up amongst his generals. And Seleucids ruled Coele Syria. And Seleucids, King Seleucus II of Syria, in 243 BC, he actually went to the temple of the god Apollo at Miletus, and there he offered to the god gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So the point is, it doesn't seem that these three gifts should be divided, that one refers to his mortal human nature, the other one refers to his monarchy, the fact that he's a king, the one refers, implies he's God. No, the whole three gifts is what a pagan would bring to offer to a god. And that's the important point. Remember, what the Magi say, that where is he who's been born king of the Jews, that we may worship him. And it says, actually, in the text, that they, when they do find him, that they fell down, they prostrated themselves, and they worshipped him. Now the point is, it wasn't just homage, not like when in Britain when someone gets knighted, becomes a knight, the queen, they kneel before the queen, and the queen touches the shoulders with the sword. Right? It wasn't like that. It wasn't homage. It was worship. What the Magi did by bringing these three gifts, these are the three gifts, the three gifts that a pagan would bring to a god. That was their way of saying, we recognize that Jesus is divine. He's not just a man, he's not just a king. Yes, he is a man, yes, he is a king, but he's also God. That's what the Magi do. That's why they worship him. So this was Seleucus II of Syria in 243 BC. And I'll repeat it, he brings the three gifts to the temple of Miletus, the temple of Apollo at Miletus. So these three gifts are sacrificial offerings to a deity.
Yeah, that is incredible. See, that's something I hadn't ever heard before. Now, to go quickly back to the nativity also with this, one of the most famous lines that will usually be told in a Christmas story is, there was no room at the inn. But scholars like Ken Bailey, for instance, have made the case that Jesus wasn't really born in like the stable of an inn. He was born more in the guest house of a certain...
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Could you expand on that some?
Yes, well, exactly. I mean, the fact is, I don't know if you have this carol, kind of children's carol in America, but we have a song here that goes rat-a-tat-tat, and it has, you often see this in kind of Christmas pageants in churches and schools, of, you know, a frantic Joseph knocking on doors, trying to find a room for the night, and finding that there's no room at the inn. And then usually says the kindly wife of the innkeeper takes pity on Mary's condition. And then this often affects sermons, actually. Because of this, you'll find a lot of sermons at Christmas talk about homelessness, and they talk about Christian social duty at Christmas. Because they say, oh, look, the Holy Family, you know, they couldn't find a place to stay. They knew what it was like to be homeless. But that isn't what it says. The word that's translated in is actually the word kataluma. And it's used in, that's in Luke 2:7. Now, this Greek word kataluma is used in Luke 22:11 and Mark 14:14 to refer to the guest room where the Last Supper was eaten. Remember, you know, elsewhere it talks about it as the upper room. Now, the only time that Luke refers to an inn is in Luke 10:34 in the parable of the Good Samaritan, but he doesn't use the word kataluma. He uses the word pandokion. The kataluma is the guest room in a private house. Now, quite likely is that when they got to Bethlehem, Joseph, being of the line of David, sought out his relatives, and they put him up. But obviously, everyone had to go back to their place of origin because of the census, so everything would have been full up, wouldn't they? So they would have had to basically sleep downstairs, where in the evening, people would bring in their animals, and they would be downstairs while everyone else was upstairs. But obviously, the kataluma, the guest room, had already been taken, so there was no room at the kataluma, at the guest room on top of the house. So they had to stay on the downstairs floor, and that's why Jesus, they're with the animals. That's why Jesus is born in placed in the manger. So he's not born in a stable. It's not because there's no room at the inn. They're born in a normal house. It's just that they have, because it's crowded, the guest room's already taken, they have to sleep downstairs. It's just like if you imagine it, most ordinary people, if they go into a wedding and all different relatives are staying, and if people haven't got a lot of money, well, the guest room might have already been taken, and then they say, all right, well, you can come and stay with us, but you've got to sleep downstairs. So you just have to rearrange the furniture at night. And that's what happened with Joseph and Mary.
Yeah, you kind of like, when my wife and I were dating, we'd some travel here to visit my folks, and naturally we'd have to stay in different rooms, and if other people were here, it'd be said, well, someone's going to have to sleep on the couch. And it's not that they were turning us away, it was just that we have only so much place. And Ken Bailey points out as well that Joseph, being of a lineage of David, would be in a position of high honor. And since the Eastern world did and still does prize hospitality greatly, no one would have truly wanted to turn Joseph away.
No, it would have been unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and that's why I said we've got to be careful, though. Because, as I said, you see this in films, you see this in documentaries, you see this in Christmas pageants, Sunday school pageants at this time of the year, and we see it in sermons. And it wasn't that they were homeless. That simply wasn't accurate. Yes, we should be concerned for the homeless at Christmas, but we can't base it on this text. It must be based on other texts.
And in the book Misreading Scripture with Western Eyes, the author states that if someone comes to a place that's far away, they'll often stay and take up a sort of temporary residence there and do odd jobs for the people. So it could very well be the case that Joseph would show up in the city and then he'd stay there for a little bit and just go about and do odd jobs for the people as a carpenter.
Yes, we don't know. I mean, obviously, the text seems to say first that they did return to Nazareth, but then they might have decided to come back to Bethlehem. So, it seems like they did decide to come back to Bethlehem, but then obviously then that's why they meet the Magi, and then they're told to flee to Egypt, and then they realize that they can't go back to Bethlehem, so they go back to Nazareth.
Yeah, and we do know that when Jesus was 8 days old, they did take him somewhere where he would be circumcised.
Yeah.
And
yes,
this
indeed.
And from the way that... Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying, it's interesting. During the medieval period, and still in some... obviously, it doesn't affect us as Protestants, but some of the Eastern churches, they still, on the 1st of January, celebrate the Feast of the Circumcision. In fact, the Anglicans and Lutherans also include it. And during the Middle Ages, rather... And weird news came about that this was the first time that the blood of Jesus was shed. And my answer to that is, if you notice, when it refers to Jesus being circumcised, there's no big emphasis on it, is there?
No.
It's almost in passing. It's almost in passing. And this is important, because often when I'm speaking to Muslims, they often say to me, have you been circumcised? And I'd say, mind your own business. And then they'll just say, well, yeah, that's just too personal. I'm not going to tell you that. And their argument is, you see, because Muslims believe it not just in the Quran, but in what's called the Sunnah. That's the practice of their Prophet Muhammad, and that's why they try to look like him, have a beard. Right?
You mean like the Hadith?
Have a beard, like in the Hadith? Yeah. Yes, that's the first real. And that's the point. Their argument is, well, look, if Jesus was circumcised, then so should you be. And I said, look, we don't have anything that relates to the Sunnah in the Bible. Can you show me a command from Jesus that I should be circumcised? That's a different matter. And the other point is, as I said, look at the way it's treated. It's just mentioned in passing. The important point for about the circumcision of Jesus is it shows he did fulfill the law. He lived it completely. But the other thing is that in 1 John he's attacking the Docetic heresy, that Jesus only appeared to be human. He wasn't truly human. Well, clearly, if he was circumcised, then he was truly human, wasn't he?
Yeah. And if anything, the main emphasis in the passages, I would say, in fact, are that two prophets, where one prophet and one prophetess in the temple, both make statements about who Jesus is and what his future is going to be.
Yeah, that's later. Afterwards, not the circumcision. And that actually, Anna and Simeon, that is actually celebrated. It was traditionally celebrated, and still is by the Anglicans, on February the 2nd. Well, before the Reformation in particular, February the 2nd was the last day of the Christmas celebration, and they call that Candlemas. And well, I think it's important we do recognize, see, with Simeon, the important point there is that is the first time that there is some kind of indication that this joyous event is going to be associated with pain. And this is one of the big dangers when we preach about on Christmas Day, or at a carol service, or do any outreach there. We keep focusing on the joy of Christmas, because of this, the cultural aspect of the celebration. Everything, this is the season of joy and goodwill and so forth. But Simeon does say to Mary that a sword will pierce your own heart as well. Already there, there's that prophecy that there's going to be some cost involved in the, with the life of Jesus. It's not extrapolated on. There's not further enlargement on this. But Simeon does make this point. There's going to be cost, and we must always, in our preaching at Christmas, we must beware of always just saying, well, everyone's talking about receiving gifts at this time, we want to talk to you about the gift of God, who's Jesus, which is all too common in sermons at this time. What we need to do also is to say, look, yes, this is great joy that Jesus was born, but right at the start, we're looking to beyond Bethlehem to Calvary. Remember even before Jesus was born, the angel says, you shall call his name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. He doesn't tell you how, but right at the start with Simeon, there's that perhaps indication it's going to be pain, or it's going to be cost. And then later, after we just talked about the Magi, Herod tries to kill Jesus. So already there we get this indication that the life of Jesus, right in the nativity narratives, it's in danger. It's in the purposes of God that's going to be some suffering. And we must always, in our Christmas preaching, throughout the period, particularly on Christmas Day, when it's one of the few times of the year, at least in Britain, that non-Christians do attend church, to point beyond Bethlehem to Calvary. And that's not doing violence to the text. It's already there in the text, incipiently.
Okay. We're going to take our break for the halfway point of the show. We're having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Anthony McCrory about Christmas traditions. When we come back, we're going to get to some more modern traditions. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com. Home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back with the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. Anthony McCrory, a visiting lecturer of the Wales Evangelical School of Theology. We're talking about Christmas traditions today. Now, if you're listening next week, my guest is going to be David Robertson of the Solar Center across the pond as well. And he's going to be talking about his book, Magnificent Obsession. Because after Christmas, we need to remember, we don't just forget about Jesus. We keep going on with him and have him be our magnificent obsession. But today we're talking about Christmas traditions. Now let's talk about some modern ones. Now in a few days, there's going to be children all around the world looking outside their window to see if they can see a sleigh flying with reindeer. And here in America, we have a tradition that you can oftentimes hear NORAD making a statement, hey, we see something, we hear some jingling out there, and everyone's looking and saying, Santa Claus is coming. Okay, what's the big deal with Santa Claus? Where does he come from?
Right. Well, the original, there was actually Nicholas, Bishop Nicholas of Myra, which is the modern Turkish city of Demre. And actually, if you look at the actual symbol of the modern Turkish city of Demre, despite the fact it's a Muslim place, it's actually Santa Claus. That's their kind of coat of arms, if you like. They get lots of visitors from the West, and particularly because St. Nicholas is a major saint in Eastern Orthodoxy, they get lots of Greek and Roman and Russian visitors. So they're very proud of the fact that Nicholas was the bishop there. And he lived there, he was bishop there from 280 to 352, round about. He lived there from 280 to 352. And his image is the bringer of gifts, has its origin in the story of how he heard that an impoverished nobleman intended to sell his three daughters into prostitution. But then God sent him incognito to throw bags of gold through the window on three different occasions. And on the third time, the nobleman caught Nicholas in the act. So again, he's already associated some way with children and with bringing gifts. And basically, by the time he became a major saint in Europe, now at first he was really associated with mariners, with sailors. He was the patron saint of sailors. He gradually began to be associated with bringing gifts of fruit, sweets and nuts. So he wasn't bringing kind of toys to people. He was bringing sweets and nuts. And in the Netherlands, Switzerland, Austria and Germany, particularly southern Germany, people celebrate St. Nicholas Day on the 6th of December. But St. Nicholas isn't like Santa Claus in America. He appears in kind of bishop's robes. And in the Netherlands, he doesn't come by sleigh, he comes by boat from Spain and not Lapland. And then he presents gifts of fruit, sweets and nuts to good children, often in shoes or clogs or stockings. And that's basically, that's why even today people still celebrate in those countries, still celebrate St. Nicholas Day on the 6th of December. And now, it's only much later that he became associated with the North Pole.
Now, there are some people who think that Nicholas Myra was actually at the Council of Nicaea as well, and there's a legend that even says he slapped down Arius the Heretic.
Yeah, it's just that. The tradition that he attended the Council of Nicaea is possibly valid. That he slapped the face of the arch-heretic Arius at the Synod, I think is most unlikely. There's no evidence for that.
Oh, that's too bad.
We don't want to encourage our pastors to become violent, do we? So, you know, we should be glad he didn't do it.
Okay. Now we've taken quite a leap, though, from being a simple guy walking around tossing gold and then eventually fruits and nuts and such, giving them to people in need, to all of a sudden you're someone at the North Pole with a great factory of several elves under there. How did we get there?
Well, essentially, the modern Santa Claus is an American creation. See, the Dutch called him Sinterklaas. And you've got to remember that New York State was originally the New Netherlands. New York was New Amsterdam, wasn't it? So there was Dutch traditions there. Mm-hmm. And Washington Irving, who the American writer who wrote also Sleepy Hollow, I believe, he wrote in his book The History of New York, written in 1809. He talks about a Dutch settler, and in one of the traditions that he looks at is that this Dutch settler has a dream where the good Saint Nicholas came riding over the top of the trees in a wagon wherein he brings yearly presents to his children. But he's not dressed the way modern Santa Claus is dressed. He's dressed as a kind of a Dutch burgher with a broad hat and a long pipe. And he drops presents from his breeches pockets, as Washington Irving puts it, down the chimneys. So there was that. There was Washington Irving. And then there was another American writer, Clement Moore, famously wrote A Visit from St. Nicholas. You know, the stockings were hung from by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. And he describes Nicholas as little and old, and he arrives in a miniature sleigh with 8 tiny reindeer. The sleigh's full of toys and flies to the house tops. Down the chimney, Nicholas comes, but he's not a great big character. He does have a rosy cheeks, he does have a nose like a cherry, a white beard, a round belly, but he's impish, he's small. And finally, he ends by saying, Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night. And essentially, the modern Santa Claus is the creation of Washington Irving and Clement Moore. And again, just to say, there's another urban legend that Santa Claus is now pictured in red because Coca-Cola invented this. That is not true. Coca-Cola just utilized it to help their sales in the winter. What happened was that there was a German immigrant to America called Thomas Nast.
Right.
And first of all, his first depiction of Santa is that he was, he shows him giving, during the Civil War, giving, dressed in the stars and stripes, giving gifts to the Northern troops. My apologies to all people in Tennessee. But that's how he pictured him, right? Later, he pictures him in tan. But then they invented coloured printing, and tan, this is when he puts him in tan. But tan, it doesn't look very impressive. And so he thought, well, let's put him in red. That sticks out a bit more. So by 1881, Nast is depicting him as, you know, with the long white beard, holding toys, you know, the pipe, big round belly, etc., etc. And in this red and white dress, which we associate him today. And so therefore, the sleigh comes in with Clement Moore, the presents come in with Washington Irving, and the red depiction comes with Thomas Nast. So essentially, the modern Santa Claus is a creation of 19th century America.
Now, do we have any tradition of gifts being given by someone that show up on Christmas morning outside of this, like before Washington Irving? Or did Washington Irving make it up wholesale, or what?
No, it wasn't. Remember, this is happening at St. Nicholas Day, not at Christmas.
Okay.
As Christmas began to bloom in the 19th century, it drew Clement Ward, brings him over to Christmas Day, and because then he's giving gifts, now he's giving, later on he's giving toys, so he moves essentially from the 6th of December to 25th, and they see, it's always a tradition for centuries to exchange gifts on New Year's Day. In fact, Queen Victoria, to Her Majesty's dying day, to the end of her life, Her Majesty's life, Queen Victoria always gave gifts on New Year's Day rather than Christmas Day. But then, as I said, as Christmas began to blossom, it drew the gifts from New Year's Day to the 25th of December, and of course that got associated with Santa Claus originally bringing sweets, but now bringing gifts. And the other thing that happened, I don't know about it, in Britain, we have something called Christmas cake, which is kind of like a fruit cake with icing on top. I don't think you have it in America. That originally was given on the 12th day of Christmas. If you ever read Charles Dickens' book, A Christmas Carol, he talks about the 12th day. That was what he gave on the 12th day of Christmas. And now it's what you eat on Christmas Day. So basically, most of what we talk about the cultural celebration of Christmas Day with Santa Claus and so forth and the Christmas cake exchanging gifts, that's really the creation of the 19th century, and particularly it's America's cultural contribution to the world.
So the giving of gifts doesn't really have anything to do with the Magi then, does it?
No, not really, no. Like I said, that doesn't seem to have been at all associated with the early spiritual celebration of Christmas, of the Nativity, not in the early generation. Most of what we associate with Christmas now, with the cultural side of it I'm talking about, that's really a creation of the 19th century. For example, the spread of the Christmas tree. The earliest reference to that, the Christmas tree, it's not a pagan article. The earliest reference to Christmas trees is from 16th century Rhineland in Germany, and it was brought to Britain originally by the wife of King George III, who, although he's not very popular in your part of the world, he's very popular here. He was a true Christian, by the way. And George III's wife, they came from Germany. They actually, Queen Catherine, Queen Charlotte, they actually celebrated in their home. But then, later on during the reign of Queen Victoria, whose husband, of course, was from Germany, Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, that they allowed themselves to be pictured by the London Illustrated News, and it showed the royal family, Queen Victoria, Prince Albert and the children, all around the Christmas tree. Now that picture was shown throughout the British, reproduced throughout the British Empire, which at that time covered a great deal of the world, and also in the USA. Now in the USA, because at the time of its Republican sentiments, they airbrushed out Queen Victoria's tiara and Prince Albert's royal sash. But that royal family have always been fashion icons. If you think of the Duchess of Cambridge today, whenever the Duchess of Cambridge wears something, it's sold out immediately on the internet within hours, is what I gather. And it's always been like that with the royal family. And the modern usage of the Christmas tree basically goes back to the Victorian age because of that picture of the royal family in front of the Christmas tree. Because once they saw that, well, everyone wanted one, of course, throughout the British Empire and throughout the USA. So that's the royal family's contribution to Christmas.
Now, let's take a brief excursus then and talk about the Christmas tree, because one thing a lot of Christians will say, and also a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses will say this time, is, well, Christmas trees are what's being talked about in Jeremiah 10.
Well, where's the evidence? I mean, in Jeremiah, did he celebrate? was there any reference to the 25th of December? And any reference to about believers doing, you know, having Christmas trees? They're not. It's basically taking a text out of context. Like I said, the earliest record of Christmas trees comes from 16th century Germany. Somehow, I don't think that's what Jeremiah had in mind. It's a ludicrous idea.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is exactly what I warned about people, urban legends, and people reproducing what someone has said and, you know, without checking, going back to the early sources. No, it was 16th century Germany. From what we gather, there's a story that, again, I'm not sure how true it is, that Martin Luther popularized this in Germany. But like I said, the fact is that it's popularized outside Germany. Essentially goes back to Queen Victoria and Prince Albert.
Mm-hmm.
That's the 19th century. That's far too late for it to have any connection with paganism.
Yeah, and that you've said earlier that in all your studies you've never found any connection then whatsoever to paganism, because we are often told again that yes, the Christmas tree was stolen from the pagans, and no, I've never seen any source whatsoever that shows that. I take it you haven't either.
No, and Jeremiah's talking about them kind of worshipping trees, aren't they? So, do we worship the Christmas tree? No, we don't. And what's more, that's the difference between the cultural celebration of Christmas and the spiritual commemoration of the Nativity. That's part of the culture of Christmas. Right? That's only an adjunct. We can do without it. But it's simply not accurate. And same thing goes with holly. I mean, here this holly and the ivy and mistletoe. Again and again, you keep hearing this comes from the pagans. But the fact is, before people were in past years were able to afford to decorate their own homes, apart from the very rich, people used to take in some greenery like holly and ivy and mistletoe, simply because that's the only kind of flora that's evergreen, that's still around at that time of the year, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that mistletoe is linked to the druids and supposedly it's supposedly something to do with druid kind of fertility rites. That all comes from Pliny the Elder, the Roman writer Pliny the Elder, in his book The Natural History. And he's not talking firsthand. He's heard from people, Romans who've been to Gaul, modern France, that the druids there believe that the mistletoe taken in drink will impart fecundity to all animals that are barren. Now notice that. It's a second-hand story, so we don't know if it's true. He's talking about the mistletoe taken in drink. Who drinks mistletoe nowadays?
And no one I know of.
Yeah, exactly. It'll kill you. Kissing under the mistletoe only began in the 18th century in Britain, long after the demise of Druidism. There was no kissing. If you look at all the references to holly and ivy and mistletoe before the 18th century, no one talks about kissing under the mistletoe until the 18th century. It's only then it begins. And that's why, like I said, it can't have anything to do with paganism. And like I said, many of these Christmas traditions are very, very late.
Well, as soon as I'm hearing this, I tell you, I'm immediately thinking, my great thanks goes out to the people of 18th century Britain. Yeah, when we were shopping for what to decorate around Christmas, I said, we have to get mistletoe, we have to get mistletoe.
Yeah, well, like I said, I'm not sure it's something I want in my house, but, you know, if you want it, then, you know, kiss your wife on the mistletoe by all means. But there's nothing pagan about it.
It's simply
to do with the fact that in years past, before people had light and before people had kind of decorations, they could, you know, like, before there was manufactured decorations, what would you do to brighten up your house during the winter months? Well, you'd bring in plants, wouldn't you? What plants that are alive in December in northern climes? Well, holly, ivy, mistletoe, and so forth. That's all that there is to it.
We're going to take our fourth commercial break here. And I'm here with Dr. Anthony McFoy. And if you have a question, our call number again is 714-242-5180. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grok Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back to the Deeper Waters podcast, where I'm learning what a great debt I have to owe to 18th century Britain right now. And I'd like to remind everyone, though, that this show is listener-supported. Everything we do here, I don't get a single penny for what I do here, and I definitely can't afford to pay my guests. They come on here free of charge, offer their time and services, and give thanks to all of them. But if you do want to support us, and especially if you want to support my own ministry of Deeper Waters, you can go to my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com and make a donation there, or you can donate through ministries like Risen Jesus and Tectonics, and through the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers, and those last three, by the way, those are tax deductible. So if you're wanting to get the end of the year giving, just go to them and say, hey, I want to support Nick Peters, I want to support Deeper Waters, and they'll be glad to pass anything on to here, and we will really appreciate anything you can give. Now, going back to the traditions we've been talking about, we took an excursus there with evergreens and such, but with Santa Claus, we were talking about beforehand. Now, how exactly, though, did we get to the idea of him living at the North Pole and having reindeer and elves working for him?
Well, remember with the reindeer, that was Henri Clement Moore. He brings this up in his poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas. Right? That's where he gets it from. And he kind of developed from there about reindeer. And he did actually name the Donner and Blitzen and everything. And then later in the 1930s, Hollywood introduced Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So again, that's very recent. Regarding the North Pole, what happened was that again in the 19th century, you have to remember that no one had actually been to the North Pole at that time.
Right.
So you might as well talk about going to Mars. So mm-hmm. the obvious place to put him is if you want to find a place for him to live, which is outside of any kind of contact, would obviously be the North Pole.
Right.
And he's a winter figure for a start. What's more wintry and snowy or icy, than the North Pole?
Exactly.
And it's simply that. So I was just saying, I've got a good friend of mine that. Who are a Canadian family, a Canadian Christian family, and we're going to be with them on the 27th. And I'm very pro-Canadian because we have the same head of state, Her Majesty the Queen. And Canada has just claimed the North Pole, and they're in a bit of dispute with Russia there. And I said, well, I hope you get it, because then in future people will have to write to Santa Claus, North Pole, Canada. So that's something else to think about.
Go on.
No, you something else you wanted to ask, wasn't there?
And then the elves. Who gave us the elves with them?
That's a very interesting story. In the Netherlands, the first idea came from in America, because this is what Washington Irving's speaking about. Dutch traditions in New York. He's associated with this figure who comes to help him, called Zwarte Piet. I don't know exactly how you pronounce it. Zwarte Piet, Black Peter. There's a bit of a problems now. Some people have questioned it on whether it's incorrect. But I'm not sure he's meant to be necessarily a black person. Some people say he was supposed to be some Moor who'd been captured, or a black slave who'd been emancipated, or the devil who Nicholas has conquered, or someone covered in chimney soot. But in Austria and southern Germany, he's far and Switzerland, he's a far more frightening character. In Switzerland, there's a singular figure with him called Schmutzli. And the best way to describe him, he looks like a monk is in monk's robes, and he's completely blackened appearance. And I don't mean in the racial sense. I'm making out he's trying to hide his features. So it's quite frightening. And it's even more frightening when you get to Austria and southern Germany, because they have someone called Krampus, which basically looks like the devil, with horns and a tail and everything. And he brings with him a chain, and he also brings with him some rods. And the original idea is that in each of these cases, in the Netherlands and Austria and Germany and Switzerland, that Santa Claus would ask the child, ask his parents, has he been naughty or nice? And if he was naughty, I think in the Netherlands they'd write him down in the book. But in Austria and southern Germany, Krampus would actually come along and start beating them. And we still have these masquerades in certain parts of Austria where these men dress up and it looks like the devil. That must be quite frightening. If you go on YouTube and type in Krampus, K-O-A-M-P-U-S, he's an absolutely terrifying figure for children. And often, I've heard cases like what happened with that, the teacher will come along down around Christmas time, walking down outside the classes, and start rattling a chain, and all the children will jump under the tables because they're scared that Krampus is going to come. And in some parts, in some of the kind of rural areas of Germany and Austria, what they'll often do, the parents will have been approached by people playing Krampus, because they all know each other, of course, and they'll say, right, my child's been a bit naughty, you come and pick him up and put him in your sack, or you put him across your knee and you spank him a little bit with the rods, which I'm not sure you'd be allowed to do these days. But you see why children would be scared. And that's what you get idea of, like in the song, he knows whether you've been naughty or nice. And you would actually be punished. And but then when he got to America, instead of having the singular helper, who was basically an imp, where it'd be like, you know, like I said, it looks like the devil almost in Austria and Germany, and even so, he's still in Switzerland, still very frightening. He metamorphosed into not just one elf, but several elves, and he became Santa's little helpers who were helping him make the toys instead of helping him punish the wicked. So Santa would give a gift to the nice children, the naughty children would get spanked or put in a sack.
And these elves traditionally also haven't been along the same lines of elves such as in Tolkien's novels, for instance.
No. It's purely a 19th century creation. Mm-hmm. It's just American metamorphosis. You know, in Austria, Germany and Switzerland and the Netherlands, he's not coming with Santa, he's coming with St. Nicholas dressed in bishop's robes. But by the time he gets to America, by the time all this is invented in the 19th century, St. Nicholas has stopped being a bishop so much. He's become the jolly red giant we all know, with the massive belly.
Right.
And his imp has been toned down from this horrible imp who beats children into Santa's cute little helpers, and they become multitudes themselves. So it's all very, very recent traditions.
I'm actually thinking about how much traditions change right now when it comes to America, because when Hindus started making a foothold over here and wanted to bring reincarnation, they found out, rather transmigration, they found out Americans weren't too happy with the idea of coming back as a rat after they died. So they said, well, you can come back, but you only come back as another human being. And then most Americans, we can do that. And so I'm listening, I wonder if Krampus pretty much got the exact same treatment over here of Americans saying, we don't like that, let's change it.
Yes, although there was an article in one of the British papers last week that it's in Portland, I forget where the other place was, two places in America, they're hoping to have, they're planning to Krampus festivals at Christmas. So he's making a revival there, which would be quite frightening for the children, I promise you.
Yeah, I've even seen some friends on Facebook and such talking about getting T-shirts that have Krampus on them and things like that.
Yeah. Well, basically, like I said, it just got toned down because it wanted to make Santa as cute as possible. And so, obviously, you transform him into... his helper, you know, from an imp, a horrible imp, into a cute little elf. And it's nothing to do with Tolkien. Obviously, it's part too early for Tolkien, you know.
One of the things that we like to do around here also is when we're not watching any Christmas special or anything else, there is a station we can turn on that just plays Christmas music, and it'll tell you what song's playing and who sings and what album is, and then we'll keep displaying Christmas facts, and a lot of the facts are around, well, here's who delivers the gifts in Holland or in Peru or in so many other places of the world, and it's so fascinating to hear the different names that Santa Claus goes by all around the world.
Yeah, well, in Britain, actually, he's sometimes called Father Christmas. And that was originally a separate figure from St. Nicholas. But what happened was that he wasn't seen as an actually existing figure. I mean, no one said to him, oh, Father Christmas is going to leave you... could leave some gifts. That wasn't what he was associated with. He was purely a personification of Christmas. Sometimes it's called Captain Christmas or Old Christmas, but Father Christmas. It's like when we talk about Father Time. Right? It was purely a personification of the season. And he wasn't big and fat, although he was with a long white beard. And basically, and particularly for many Protestants, he was a very spiritual character. He wasn't associated with bringing gifts. He was associated with celebrating Christmas, but some of the writings, like John Taylor's The Complaint of Christmas, this is talk about Christmas being Father Christmas, 1631, he writes, "Therefore England, beautiful, fruitful, and yet blessed land, take heed lest thy gluttony, pride, and excess, covetousness, bribery, and extortion, have the adamantine force to pull down heaven's judgments on thee, as they did on Sodom. And instead, Father Christmas urges England to be pious. Heaven is bountiful and patient, be thou penitent and thankful." And I think in many ways, for many evangelicals who are a bit concerned of talking about Santa Claus, a figure that doesn't actually exist, to their children, I've recommended this in the past. Maybe we should talk about revive Father Christmas as he originally was. You know, the debate of them isn't a figure that really exists, it's just a personification of the season. But if you look at the writings in the 17th century about Father Christmas, I think most evangelical Protestants would find it very welcoming. For example, a nun's work appeared during the sad time that Britain was a republic in the Cromwellian era. It's called Christmas In and Out, 1652. And Father Christmas defends himself against charges of popery by saying his real name is Christ Sent, and insists that his day is, and this quote now, is kept in a thankful remembrance of Christ's blessed incarnation. And then it goes on to say, Father Christmas said, Christ is the Prince of Peace. His peace you will never have that do unthankfully despise and neglect to solemnize his most blessed nativity. I think we can all say amen to that, can't we?
Yeah, I certainly can. And you know, it's so amazing that you made this statement when you did, because one of the questions I was wanting to ask you soon would be, what should parents do? Because a lot of Christian parents do wrestle with this, because they say, you know, we want our children to have the joy and gifts and benefits of Santa Claus, but at the same time, we don't want to be lying to them or giving them a myth or having them say later on, well, geez, if Santa Claus isn't real, maybe God isn't real as well. So they feel like they're walking a fine line. So what should Christians be doing meanwhile? Do you have any recommendations for that?
That's why I wrote about this with Christianity Today some years ago, about Father Christmas, because no one ever thought of him as actually existing. So you're not telling your children a lie or a myth. You're just saying he's the personification of the season, just like Father Christmas is personification, the Father Time is personification of time. Like Britannia, who's the kind of warrior lady, is the personification of Britain, or Uncle Sam is personification of America, or Columbia is personification of America. No one actually thinks there is an old man called Uncle Sam, or a woman holding a torch called Columbia, do they? And I think perhaps if we could remind Father Christmas rather than Santa Claus, because in Britain we use the two names interchangeably. because basically, as Santa Claus was introduced from America, he kind of joined together with Father Christmas in Britain. So we use the two terms interchangeably. Now, one of the interesting things is in southern Germany and Austria, particularly under Martin Luther's influence, they tried to do away with St. Nicholas and anything else, for that matter. And at by the time they got to the Christmas period, what they used to do was get, and they still do this, they get usually a pretty young girl, teenage girl, to dress up as what they call the Christkindl, the Christ child, right? And she gives gifts. You know, she's playing Jesus as a child, and she gives gifts to coming Christ. Now, when that got to America, introduced by German immigrants, that got corrupted, just like Santa Claus got corrupted to Santa Claus. Christkindl got corrupted to Kris Kringle, and then associated with Santa Claus. Now, in Britain, we never call Santa Claus Kris Kringle. That's purely an American thing. But that's one other alternative. What they do in kind of some Lutheran churches is to have the Christ child giving gifts. So there's two possibilities, Father Christmas or the Christ child. Both of them linked with not just material issues, but rather talked about, as I said, the quotes I gave, talk about spiritual matters.
Right. But what that leaves me wondering is, okay, the parents, the children go to bed on Christmas Eve night, and when they wake up in the morning, usually the presents are already there. So do the parents then say, Father Christmas came by, or the Christ child came by, or what do they say exactly at that point?
Well, they say, you can say, you know, obviously people say, in Britain say Father Christmas, who's seen now as synonymous with Santa Claus. But I'm saying if we revive the older classical view of Father Christmas, we don't need to say, we make it clear to them that it's just a personification. So they know that the children, the parents who brought them, but we're saying, this is what the Christmas season has brought you. This is what Father Christmas, i.e. the season, like when we talk, Americans talk about Uncle Sam wants you, or, you know, you pay your taxes to Uncle Sam. But, you know, not everyone knows, you're not talking about some mythical old man in a hat, you know, you're talking about the US government, aren't you? Or the US itself. I think that's one thing you can do. The Christkindl, from what I gather, it's actually a girl in the period leading up to Christmas. At some church service, they choose a girl to play the Christ child, and she hands out gifts to them at these kind of services. So that's one of the possibilities in America particularly, you know, because a very large people of German origin there.
So the recommendation then is that hopefully those of us in American culture will move away from the modern add-ons we've given to the Santa Claus figure and go back instead to the Father Christmas figure.
Yes, that's something I would recommend for children. Yes, because let's point out that he's not actually, in fact he wasn't even associated with giving gifts to children in Britain before the 19th century. It was just simply associated with the Christmas celebration. But again, again and again, when you hear about him, like another title, The Vindication of Christmas, written in 1653, sometimes he's called Old Christmas or Father Christmas, where he's a slim, tall man with a long but not bushy beard. And in this writing, he ends by saying, "Love one another as my master loved you. Relieve the oppressed, call home exiles, help the fatherless, cherish the widow, and restore to every man his due." And I think if we want to revive that kind of figure, focuses our attention not simply on someone who gives gifts, but someone who's the personification of the ethical and worshipful attitudes we should have, not just at Christmas, but at all times.
Right.
This is the focusing on the activity. Yes, love one another as my master loved you. You can't get much more much more Christian than that, can you?
No. Well, it's time for our next break. We do have a caller, so how about, would you be open to, when we get back from a break, taking a caller question?
Sure. By all means.
Okay.
Okay, well, Carter, stay on the hold. We'll get back to you after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show. Free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. We're here with Dr. Anthony McCrory talking about Christmas traditions, and we've got a caller with a question. So, caller, you are on the air.
Hi, how are you both doing?
Fine.
Very well, thank you.
Hey, great. I have a question. I'm trying to see how we can connect Christianity and Christmas when A, there is no real Santa Claus flying in the sky, and where B, Christianity does have a history of being involved in various forms of war, etc. Seems to be somewhat the opposite of love and truth and peace.
Well, firstly, I think I've already just answered about Santa Claus. But different possibilities one can raise about the Father Christmas or the Christ Child. About war and peace, well, obviously that's a different question, really. That does the gospel teach pacifism? Does it teach the just war? And when we talk about Christianity being involved, well, I think we've got to be careful there. There's nothing in the New Testament which says that we must fight for God. In fact, I remember a few months ago I was speaking to some rather militant Muslims who actually support Al-Qaeda. And I just said, I was talking to them, and I said, look, we cannot fight for Christ. We cannot fight for God. And they were shocked and said, no, you wouldn't fight for God. I said, yeah, no, I'll fight for the Queen and for my country, but I will not fight for God. The simple reason is that that's a contradiction of the gospel. Jesus said in John 18, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, then would my servants fight. So I think it's legitimate to serve in the armed forces of your country, but it's not legitimate to fight for God. So in that sense, there aren't any Christianity has not been involved, or not proper biblical Christianity has not been involved in any wars, because it's a contradiction in terms. You cannot fight for Christianity with material weapons. If you do so, it's actually violating Christianity. You can fight for your country, but that's all you can fight for.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a very valid perspective that you give, because I see, for instance, YouTube videos of another group, cutting people's heads off in the name of their God, and I think, do you really think your God can't use a sword? You know, it seems so unbelievable that our world is full of so much, you know, death, man-made, caused by men, but yet people put a, you know, spiritual spin on it. Well, we're doing this because our God is better than your God. So your perspective is very refreshing. It's rare that I hear that kind of perspective from people who have a very religious angle. I consider religion to be very different from spirituality, because spirituality actually does have much evidence of it. Atoms, they're so tiny we can't see them with our eyes, so clearly there's spirituality. But I don't generally see religion as the mechanism to be spiritual. I think the person, nature, and your own self introspection, research, meditation is the way to go. So for 2014, on the Judeo-Christian calendar, of course, because humanity is way older than that, I'm hoping more people can, you know, dig deep and go beyond what we were taught as children and just do thought experiments and see if we can make a better world, because we're headed the wrong way, I think, as a society and as a civilization, Homo sapiens sapiens.
Well, I'm not sure that sinful man can really make a better world. What we can do is, when we receive the Holy Spirit in the new birth, we can actually seek to be sanctified, and we can act in a sanctified manner. And but just to bring back to Christmas, one of the things, one issue that we need to remember in regard to Christmas is what happened in the First World War. Now, America only entered the First World War in 1917, but the First World War actually began in 1914. And in that year, and that year alone really, a tremendous event took place in 1914. Normally, the two trenches, the British were singing "It's the Long Way to Tipperary." Tipperary is a place in Ireland. And the Germans were singing "Back to Am Rhein." As Christmas Day approached, both sides started to sing carols. And the Germans started to place Christmas trees in the trenches. And then the British heard the Germans singing, German troops singing "Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht," which is "Silent Night, Holy Night." And the British responded with carols. And on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, the two sides emerged from the trenches to offer mutual Christmas greetings and fraternize, and then started playing football. And this was completely spontaneous. It wasn't official. In fact, some of the officers got really annoyed when they heard about it. But it lasted for a short time, and they started playing soccer together, football, as we call it. And there, for that short time, in that horrible war, for that one day, Christmas Day, there really was peace on earth and goodwill on the Western Front.
Are you suggesting that that peace was brought about by Christmas or by people believing in something jointly and therefore deciding to be peaceful? The two things seem to be mutually exclusive. One can happen without the other. A group of people can be in a situation and decide, you know what, this makes no sense. Or were you just giving it as a story to, you know, show that we can do positive during Christmas, whether or not we believe in it, we can do some good in the world?
No, my point was quite that. Look, they didn't do it on any other day, did they? They did it spontaneously on Christmas Day. They did it by starting to sing Christmas carols. And then they went off over to greet each other and fraternize. People against whom they'd been shooting, and later they would shoot again. But for that one day, Christmas Day, not any other day, not any kind of any day in the either country's major calendar, that it was simply Christmas Day, they actually did have peace on earth. And I think that's important when we look at Christmas. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your feedback. This was a sensational discussion. You're very open-minded, and I thank you for your time, folks. And I hope you all have a great new year and stay healthy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Hotef Kenyatta. Bye-bye.
God bless you.
And for anyone interested, I will say I am looking into getting guests on here to discuss those kinds of events in Christian history, such as the Crusades, the Inquisition. So if you're listening to the show, keep listening. It's going to happen. But that really was an incredible story that you just told about a war that they kind of held that little ceasefire on Christmas Day.
And it was complete. Ordinary soldiers, and you can still see photographs of them doing it, playing football, playing soccer, and the officers that tried to prevent it on either side prevented it from happening again. So there was a great deal it was a scandal almost that they did this, because obviously if you're at war, you want to encourage your troops to keep fighting, don't you? You want to get friendly with the other side. But the interesting point is when it happened, it didn't happen on New Year's Day, it happened on Christmas Day. And I think that's very important and very moving.
Do we have any word of what the commanding officers thought about what was going on?
Oh, they tried to stop it, very obviously. I mean, from their perspective, firstly, the troops were under orders to fight, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do. You can imagine now, the commanders of American forces would feel in Afghanistan if suddenly, out of the blue, instead of your American forces and our British forces fighting the Taliban, they decide to drop everything and start saying, "Well, how are you doing, fellow?" and "Can I give you some chocolate?" They'd be outraged, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah.
And so, So you can see there that quite obviously the officers on both sides were absolutely appalled about this, because enemy soldiers are meant to fight, not to fraternize. And what's more, it had been completely unauthorized. There was no truces, ceasefires had to be agreed between the powers. This hadn't been agreed. This was just sort of spontaneous between the ordinary soldiers. And if you go on YouTube, you can find a song actually by an American folk singer, even though it concerned really British, to a lesser extent French, and then German troops, a man called John McCutcheon. He wrote a song about Christmas troops, which was called Christmas in the Trenches, which is a fictionalized account of a British soldier from Liverpool calling it's worthwhile looking it up, and if you want to read about it, cause it's a very moving time. I mean, you think of all what it was like in the trenches. It was full of mud, it was rat infested, vermin infested, people, you know, the food was horrible, people were being killed left, right and centre. And for that one day, there is peace, there is goodwill, there is friendship, and they do the most natural thing of all things to do, they play football together.
It really kind of reminds you that the coming of Christ was meant to transform everything, and perhaps on that day it certainly did have a transforming effect for those men. Brings us back right quick also to, since we're getting close to the end of the session here, we were talking about these kinds of traditions, and Santa Claus, you have to be sure also, when we're talking about him, there again is nothing pagan about that one either, is there? Just seems that with so many Christians today, unfortunately, there is this great big scare around Christmas that they are going to be getting into something pagan. I mean, I've told my own wife the analogy of that some people say wedding rings are of a pagan origin, and if someone came to me and could prove that indisputably to me, I'd say, well, that's interesting, but I'm sure not taking off my ring, because I know the reason I wear this ring. It's not to honor any pagan deity. I wear it to honor her. And even if something of Christmas was of pagan origin, we know why we're doing it.
Well, like I said, in the end, the Bible's very clear about what we do not do. We do not take part. We won't attend in pagan festivals. For example, that's why if I had a job when I first moved to London 20 years ago, when I had to bring Anglican theological schools to the Gurudwara, Sikh Gurudwara, and the Hindu temple. And the Hindu temple, they always used to give us a gift of an orange. And I was happy to take that. What we cannot do is to, well, you have to see Hindus in the temple, pour milk over their idols. We can't take part in Hindu festivals. You know, and
right.
In regards to the food they offer us, that's what gets us. It's everything with Thanksgiving. But we can't take part in non-Christian worship. That's why, you know, with Muslim neighbours, I live in an area where there's a big Muslim area in East London. And you know, at different times around Ramadan, they brought me Ramadan food. But we do eat it. Do I take part? What I want to do is go to the mosque and take part in their prayers on Friday. I don't mean offensive, but I'm just saying, obviously, I do not take part in non-Christian worship. Now, there's nothing wrong about eating food that's been cooked by Muslims or Hindus or whatever. The Buddhist food. That's what Paul is basically saying. Basically, they've been slaughtered by pagans, may have been offered to idols. Food is food. What you don't take part in is the pagan celebration, pagan worship itself. So, you know, it's going to be, like for example, the rings are rings. Let's take crowns. I mean, most monarchies throughout history have had crowns. Well, they call them the leaders kings. What is Jesus called? King.
Well, we're getting here towards the end of our show. We've got less than 5 minutes left. Now, Dr. McRoy, I've been told by you that if anyone wanted to get in touch with you, they can do that through the Wales Evangelical School of Theology. Just contact them, and they'll contact you. Do you have a website or a book or anything that people can go to if they want to get some more information?
I have written one on this, on the subject of Christmas, to deal with all these issues, but fortunately, I've not been able to find it for this year, because obviously it's not the kind of thing that I'm interested in. If you want to contact me, it's at west.org.uk.
Okay. Now, with 4 minutes... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
With just less than 4 minutes left, it's be the final message that my audience gets to hear before Christmas. What do you want to tell us to keep in mind this Christmas? What final message would you like to leave for my audience today? I'd like to thank you for coming on. I hope you've enjoyed your time. It's certainly been a very informative time, and I hope it's made everyone look at their Christmas traditions closer and appreciate what we have. And I certainly do hope you and yours and all my listeners out there that you do have a very Merry Christmas this year. We're certainly going to be doing everything at the Peterson's to make sure that we have such a Christmas. Now, if you're listening next week, we're going to have David Andrew Robertson coming on. He's going to be talking about his book, Magnificent Obsession. But for now, Dr. McRoy, thank you for coming on and giving us your time, and a Merry Christmas to you across the pond.
And thank you very much for inviting me. I've enjoyed my time there. A blessed Christmas to everyone in America. I have lots of American friends here and in the U.S. We are very conscious of the historical and cultural links between Britain and America. God bless all the Americans in this Christmas.
Thank you. And with that, we are going to be signing off, and I will see you next week on the Deeper Waters Podcast.